I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, a memorial to the thousands of gays persecuted by the Nazis is dedicated in Berlin. And the original dream girl, Cheryl Lee Ralph, talks about her efforts to get women to face the facts on HIV/AIDS. But first, to the Supreme Court. Today, the Supreme Court struck down the District of Columbia's strict three-decade-old ban on handguns, saying Americans do have an individual right to own guns under the Second Amendment. The decision was in one of the more emotional cases taken by the court this term. Yesterday, it decided that states cannot put someone to death for raping a child when no death occurs. Joining us now to talk about both cases are Mary Che. She is a law professor at George Washington University. She is also a councilwoman in the District of Columbia. And Jonathan Franklin, who heads the Supreme Court and appellate practice in the Washington, D.C. office of Fulbright and Jaworski. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the decision on the handgun ban. Jonathan, what was the issue here?
Well, the issue was the constitutionality under the Second Amendment of the District of Columbia's effective ban on handguns. And the court today ruled that that ban does violate the Second Amendment to the Constitution.
I'm so curious, though, Jonathan, why it took so long to bring an issue like this to the fore. This whole question of gun rights is such a hot-button issue, and it's taken some 7 decades before an issue like this has been litigated. Why did it take so long, and why this particular case?
Well, most courts prior to the decision below in this case had held that the Second Amendment was limited to a right related to the militia service. And there had been a couple of cases about holding an individual right. But this was the first real serious challenge based on the individual rights theory that had been adopted in the lower court. And the District of Columbia's ban, I think, is widely viewed as either the most restrictive or at least one of the most restrictive in the country.
Mary Che, it's my understanding that this law was widely supported in the District of Columbia, both by public officials and by citizens. What do you believe the scope of this? What's the impact of this decision? Is there any immediate impact? And how are D.C. officials responding to it?
Well, the council will be meeting, actually, today to talk about it. And having gone through the opinion, I was quickly trying to assess what we're going to be able to do in terms of continued regulation. And among the things that it appears we can still do is we can ban concealed weapons. We can identify certain people who may not be able to possess them, felons, for example, mentally ill persons, ban them in special places like courthouses or schools, ban dangerous or unusual weapons, because the court, the majority, this 5-4 majority, said handguns are overwhelmingly the weapon of choice for self-defense, but other weapons, I assume, you know, machine guns, that sort of thing. The court said it wasn't going to address licensing. It did talk about our ability to have qualification on the commercial aspect, you know, sale of guns, but it refused to take the lightest kind of review that could have been available to us, namely to say any regulation that we adopted that was rational. It rejected that and talked about an inherent right of self-defense. So it appears as though, consistent with the case, that we must permit people to carry handguns or have handguns in their home. What's unclear, if they talk about an inherent right of self-defense, is whether we would have to permit people to have handguns outside of the home so long as they were not concealed. That seems to be an uncertain aspect of this, but what we will do is we will look at whatever we can to adopt regulations that would now be consistent with the court's decision.
Mary, it seems to me that the issue here was reasonableness. District officials argued that the district's ban on handguns was a reasonable crime, public safety measure. Why do you think that the court decided that it wasn't? Was it just overbroad, or they say that the fundamental right overwhelms these restrictions that the district had?
Well, I think they said the latter, because at the end of the majority opinion, Justice Scalia acknowledged that there are major policy arguments in favor of a handgun ban, such as the District of Columbia, or at least said, you know, not necessarily approving of them, but said, look, this is a constitutional right, and those considerations of policy have to give way to what he saw as a clear individual right to possess handguns in the home, at any rate.
A very hotly contested issue, the very lengthy opinion, something like sort of 200 pages, and there's also a dissent by the 4 members who dissented, but a lot of amicus briefs filed by groups on both sides. Jonathan, I wanted to ask you about the issue of race here. One of the groups that filed an amicus brief argued that the ban is racist, that historically one of the reasons that jurisdictions have implemented gun bans is to keep them out of the hands of freed slaves, freed former slaves. It's like a second-class citizenship question. And their argument is that the District of Columbia, given its demographics, is being subjected to second-class citizenship by not allowing its citizens to have a right which is enjoyed in other places. Was that a relevant argument?
I have not yet had a chance to study the full opinion. I did not see that issue addressed in the opinion itself. I do think that folks on both sides have used the race issue in the way that you suggested on the side of those who are opposing the ban. It was noted that a lot of gun control laws in the South, in any event, were trying to keep weapons out of the hands of freed slaves. Others, though, have noted that the violence that is perpetrated by handguns is predominantly in urban areas, many urban areas, affecting the African-American community. So I think it's on both sides.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and I'm speaking with law professor Mary Che, who's also a D.C. council member, and Jonathan Franklin, a partner at Fulbright and Jaworski, about this week's Supreme Court decisions on gun control and the death penalty. I want to wheel around and talk about that death penalty case where the court issued an opinion yesterday. The court decided that states cannot put somebody to death for raping a child when no death occurs. Jonathan, the facts of the case that came before the court were fairly horrific. The court did not shy away from that. A man raped his 8-year-old stepdaughter, hurt her so badly she had to have surgery. Why did the court decide that the punishment was not, as Justice Kennedy put it, a proportional punishment?
First, I'd like to note that these opinions show Justice Kennedy in his true swing vote status. He was in the majority in both cases, with the generally more conservative justices in the gun case and with the generally more liberal justices in the death penalty case. The court held that it is unconstitutional to impose the death penalty for the crime of child rape. And the court actually even went further and held that in a case of an individual crime, it is unconstitutional to apply the death penalty where no death resulted. The court applied its standards from other cases, which focus on evolving standards of decency, and held that because of the rarity of child rape prosecutions for child rape, the rarity under which it is actually penalized, as well as other factors inherent in the crime itself, that it was not going to, in its view, extend the death penalty to those circumstances.
Jonathan, I wanted to ask you again about the role of race. The American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund had said an historical consensus had existed against the death penalty for rape, except for some states that seemed to use it to target African-American men, particularly when the victim was of a different race. Did the racial imbalance, something that's also very much discussed, of the way the death penalty is applied, play any role in the court's decision?
Well, it did not get mentioned in the court's decision. There were others that had informed the court. For example, the court noted that I think 455 people were executed prior to 1964, which is the last time someone was executed for a rape, either adult or child. And it was noted in to the court that 89% of those defendants were African-American. And in this case, both the victim and the perpetrator was African-American. I do think that it played a role to this extent. The court, in its opinion, really expressed, and the majority here, it's a slim majority, expressed a deep skepticism about the death penalty in general in terms of its arbitrariness. And one of the ways that people in the past have always noted that arbitrariness is in the statistics dealing with African Americans, particularly where the victim is white. And the arbitrariness of the death penalty is, I think, clearly a factor in the court not wanting to extend the penalty in this circumstance.
Now, I know you're both digesting these two recent decisions on these very complicated and emotional issues, but I wanted to ask if you just take a minute thinking about this term as a whole. Where did the court leave us on some of these very divisive issues in our society? Jonathan, do you have a thought about that? Is there a kind of a point of view emerging here that we'll look back on this term as being sort of pivotal and shaping either our sort of our legal framework for dealing with some of these controversial issues or the way it affects public opinion?
Well, it's hard to discern a clear trend. I think the cases today and yesterday show Justice Kennedy in the role of the decider. And in 5-4 cases, he's often the deciding vote. The gun case, I think, is a landmark precedent. It is the first time the court has dealt with this issue in 70 years. It's the first exhaustive treatment. And the court, I think, somewhat deliberately left open a whole slew of issues. It declined, for example, to even express a view as to the standard of review that ought to be applied, other than saying it did not appear to be rational basis. So the lower courts, I think, are going to be struggling with this issue, Second Amendment issue, for years to come. And the court, I think, somewhat deliberately left it in that position.
Mary Chay, what about you? Final thought?
Well, I do agree certainly that Justice Kennedy is the hinge in these cases and will continue to be. But, you know, at the same time, again, it's hard to have one sort of sweeping summary, though I would say, for example, the court, in terms of its habeas decision with respect to the detainees in Guantanamo, also put down a marker, which it has been putting down, in terms of the limits of presidential power and individual liberties. But, yes, this gun case will spawn many, many additional cases. Law review articles will be written. People will get tenure based on their analysis of this case. And it will have real-term effects in communities like mine in the District of Columbia. And actually, I'm quite anxious about what the ill effects will be.
Mary Chay is a law professor at George Washington University. She's also a councilwoman in the District of Columbia. She joined us from her office at the council. Jonathan Franklin is a litigation partner and head of the Supreme Court and Appellate Practice of Fulbright and Jaworski. He was kind enough to join us in our studio in Washington. Thank you both so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you as well.